Good morning. This is Focus 580, a morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. Later this month, a television science program called NOVA, you might have heard of it, presents a four-part miniseries called Origins about the beginnings of Earth, life, and the universe. The program airs on WILL-TV at 7 p.m. next Tuesday and Wednesday, September 28th and 29th, and I'm sure on many other PBS stations. On WILL-AM, we're never shy about shilling for our sister TV station, so in this hour of Focus 580, we'll have a conversation with the host of this NOVA series, Neil deGrasse Tyson. Although Neil deGrasse Tyson was voted sexiest astrophysicist alive by People magazine in the year 2000, he is much more than a pretty face. He is director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. He earned a PhD in astrophysics from Columbia University and is the author of seven books on cosmology. They include One Universe, At Home in the Cosmos, The Sky is Not the Limit, an autobiography that he wrote, Cosmic Frontiers, Astronomy at the Cutting Edge, and Just Visiting This Planet, a collection of columns he wrote for Stardate magazine, and also the book we'll discuss today, which is a companion to the Origin series on NOVA. The book is entitled Origins, 14 Billion Years of Cosmic Evolution, and it is published by Norton. During this hour, we'll talk about the science of cosmology and about the synthesis of other sciences toward addressing questions on the origins of life on this planet and perhaps others. A big topic, but as we talk with Neil Tyson, you are invited into the conversation. Your questions are welcome. All you have to do is call us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. So if you're listening on the internet anywhere in the continental U.S., use the toll-free line, and please do feel free to join us. Neil Tyson joins us this morning by telephone. Good morning.
Yeah, a pleasure to be there.
Well, thanks for being with us.
Mm-hmm.
It is a wonderfully readable book, and a strong argument, I think, not only about the concepts that you cover, but for applying science to some very profound questions.
Well, we try. I think that's the only way you can do science. I mean, one of the challenges of science education has been, well, how do you take all these complex ideas and also complex vocabulary and turn it into something that is palatable? I'm privileged to be a working member of the astrophysics community, because what makes us a little different is that we don't go out of our way to create big vocabulary words for things. So, for example, the beginning of the universe, the official name for that is Big Bang.
Right.
That's two syllables, done and over with. Mm. Whereas, of course, in biology, you know, the most important molecule in life has 10 syllables to it. So part of what makes writing about astronomy a little more accessible than what you might find in other subjects is because we have a fun and very accessible lexicon. But also, there's a lot out there that we can show a picture of and describe, and I think we're also appealing to a natural, perhaps even genetically encoded curiosity that humans have for looking up and asking the same questions across time and through culture. You know, how did it all begin? What is my place in this universe? So I have to say, we're working with good material.
Yeah, well, indeed. The couple things in your answer there that I'm struck by. Number one, the book contains a number of these amazing images that you mentioned. We have these, you know, just spectacular views of the universe through the scientific instruments that we've developed. I know you've done a lot of work on the Hubble.
Yes.
And, you know, these images are just breathtaking.
Yeah, and that's right. And by the way, when those images end up as cover stories in the weekly, in the news weeklies or in a city's newspaper, you know, I didn't run around and twist editors' arms to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't say, you do this or else. They chose to do that on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that people have a deep sense of feeling just by gazing into those images. And so what the book is about is, it's how do you take these gorgeous images and learn and gain insight into what it means.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a little harder to do, because if all we wanted to do was show pretty pictures, we could have just made a picture book, which this isn't.
Yeah.
It has some pictures in it, but they're more as a reward for having learned what it all means.
Mm-hmm.
And so But right, there's nothing more photogenic than the cosmos.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the notion that we are perhaps genetically encoded to be curious about the universe and to understand how it began and where it's going and led to us and so forth. And I think among cosmologists there's this sense of compulsion to study these issues. Almost as if, and I think some have articulated it like this, the universe created us so that it could understand itself or something.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a philosophical stretch, but
right.
It's fun to think that way,
yeah.
That here's this universe. Odd it would be if there were no intelligence within it to look upon it. But we're here, and we define ourselves as intelligent, although we could debate that, of course, and given that fact, now the universe has found a way to get figured out,
mm-hmm.
a task that we take on happily and willingly.
Yeah. Well, there's also a tension, I think, and you note this, at the very beginning of the book, it's a philosophical sort of, there are different philosophical camps on this in terms of, the relationship between faith or the notion of how the universe was created and the scientific attempt to understand those things without accepting some magical instance of creation. And you hear cosmologists, for example, a few months ago, we spoke with Jana Levin, who wrote this wonderful book, How the Universe Got Its Spots.
Mm-hmm.
And she voices very clearly in there that she has this belief, whether it's true or not, that the universe is constructed in a way that we can understand it, that it is possible for us to get this complete understanding of the structure of the universe.
Well, you shouldn't overread into her usage of the word belief in
yeah.
that sentence,
mm-hmm.
simply because efforts to understand the universe have proven successful in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a track record upon which she bases that sentence.
Yeah.
So which is strongly distinct from how the word belief might be used by a religious person,
mm-hmm.
where a belief system is something for which you don't actually go out and look for proof because you neither need it nor require it, because the system of thought is completely contained within itself.
Yeah.
And that's all you need, and then you live with that. So she's saying that, but she's got 400 years of successful science to back it up.
I think also, and not to get too wrapped up into this particular aspect of the conversation, because there's a lot of things I want to talk with you about, but I think the word intuition also enters into the conversation. And it's another one of those words that it's sort of difficult to, is it an intuition based on, as you say, experience and a track record, or a sort of an insight that maybe we don't understand it ourselves, how our brain comes to give us answers to things that then prove to be true, or at least a theory that isn't disproved over the course of experiment. But I guess I'm asking you, the question would be, what do you think is the role of intuition in the exploration of science and understanding?
I think, first of all, the human mind is vastly more complex than the universe. So I got it easy. I'm only an astrophysicist. The neuroscientists, they got their work cut out for them. That's my first comment.
Sure.
Second, intuition, normally when we think about it, it's does someone have insight into the machinery of some phenomenon or some object or some process? And often those insights come about from familiarity with classes of phenomena and classes of problems that you spend time with, and so you get a sense of how what turn it will take next or what behavior it will exhibit next. And so, by the way, there are plenty of people who are credited with deep insights in the universe because we remembered their hits and have discarded their misses.
Right.
So Einstein, applying all of his life's insight, was certain that quantum mechanics was not some fundamental concept in the universe. And all evidence shows that he's just simply wrong. Quantum mechanics is the science of the small,
yeah.
how we understand how particles behave. And they seem to follow rules that are so foreign to what you would ever experience in everyday life that the first people to discover these, they just couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
And they couldn't believe it because, getting back to a point you hinted at, they were invoking their common sense as a judgment on whether or not it was true. But our senses are things we grew up with. And we don't grow up playing dominoes with atoms. We don't. There's whole aspects of the universe that fall completely outside of our life experience. So when things happen there that don't sort of fit how you think it ought to be, you can't use that fact as a judgment against it. You have to look at the data and let the data speak for itself. And so there are people who are very close to the data and close to the mathematics of the data. The mathematics is the language with which we converse with the cosmos. Once you have a sensitivity to that language, it's like learning the words of a new language and then having a new idea that you express in that new language. Once you know how certain rules about what constrain the universe, you can apply those rules in a fresh and interesting way. And that happens all the time in science. And those are people who have certain mathematical insights. So yes, insight matters. Hunches matter. It's not all deduction, conclusion. It's not all lab book, dry lab book. It's inspiration can come from all directions within the mind. And we don't claim to understand how and why, and some people have a better track record than others, but it's still, in the end, you have to answer to the universe. You can't just do it from your armchair.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. I wonder if this you mentioned a couple things. One is the language of mathematics that many of us just simply don't have, at least in terms of dealing with the concepts.
And let me tell you something. I got to butt in. There's no excuse for that. You know why? Because if you want, let's say you want to go to China and you want to be fluent in Chinese, mm-hmm. you know you're going to have to learn an alphabet. You're going to have to spend years studying it mm-hmm. to become fluent. There are different phonations. There's a whole different... They don't even have words the way we think of words assembled from parts. Characters are whole thoughts unto themselves. So it's a whole new way to do it. You invest the time to do it. Yeah. Take you 5 years to be fluent and to understand the culture. If you spend that kind of effort learning math, you can then have that same conversation with the universe. Mm-hmm. People are taught math without knowing that there's something out there that they could use it to have a conversation with. They think it's just to torture you in school.
Well, that's really interesting because we've been saying that for decades now. Kids sit there and go, why am I studying this?
Why am I studying this? And I say, one day, do you want to have a conversation with the universe? I want to have a conversation with the universe. I want to have a conversation with the planets that orbit the sun, with the moons that orbit the planets, with the galaxies that orbit the center of their superclusters, because I want to know. And then they see it from a whole other kind of light. And, you know, I think there's some issues out there that need to be resolved so that people don't see math as some barrier. And yes, it's hard. And yes, it's got symbols that you don't recognize. Well, so does the Cyrillic alphabet. So does the Greek alphabet. Greeks don't have a problem with it. Yeah. They just learn it and use it, of course, because it's their native language. So, I'm screaming at you here.
That's okay. No, it's good. You've got to be passionate about this stuff, I think. And as you obviously
got me started on it.
It's my fault.
I was perfectly happy talking about something else.
Okay.
You got me started on my math thing.
Okay. Well, maybe we can come back to that. That's kind of fun. The other part of what you said is that we don't have familiarity with the way things work on a quantum level. They're not intuitive in the sense that we're familiar with them. And I guess I wanted you to address this sort of... this transition between classical physics and modern physics and the difficulty we've had in making that transition in our own understanding.
Well, the leading physicists of the day who were trained in what we call classical physics, mm-hmm. so Newtonian laws of motion and gravity and the like, you know, when the new physics came up, this quantum physics and relativity physics, some of them didn't take it very well. And they were certain it must be wrong because it didn't fit into their common sense. And some people become so ossified in their views that you just have to sort of, it sounds crude, but it's a fact, that you just wait until they get old and die, and then they're out of the mix. And the next generation learns of this process as a very natural behavior of the universe, mm-hmm. and you no longer have this sort of cognitive dissonance trying to understand it. So we've been stumped enough times in the past 100 years that we no longer look at new exotic ideas as something foreign to be shunned.
Yeah.
We look at them as intriguing, and if they help us calculate something new in the universe, we jump all over it.
Mm-hmm.
Same goes for string theory and all these other sort of frontier concepts.
Yeah. Well, and I think a lot of people who haven't, learned the language and may have just read some popular books about these things still kind of scratch their heads and go, string theory, quantum mechanics, things don't, something can be both a particle and a beam at the same time. And, that it doesn't exist in any particular place, but there's a probability that it may exist in all kinds of places. And, I probably stated that very badly.
No, you stated it perfectly. I give you an honorary degree for that, those two sentences. And by the way, consider that, yes, one of many basic tenets of quantum mechanics is that particles can just as legitimately be described as waves. Mm-hmm. And then you're stuck saying, but which is it really? And the fact is, our vocabulary wasn't born in that environment. Otherwise, we would have just had a word for things that could be two things at once, mm-hmm. like wavicle, wave and particle. But we don't have these words. We don't even have these thoughts.
Yeah.
So, we have thoughts and words for other things that are very natural to us. Like, you drop something, it falls. The word fall means it's falling, it goes in the direction of gravity, and that's natural to us. If we dropped it and it went up, and if everything did that, that would be natural.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone dropped something and it fell down, you'd say, what happened there?
Yeah.
Some new law of physics is at work. That doesn't make sense that it fell down to the ground. So, like I said, you just grow accustomed to what is different, and then that brings on a new kind of insight.
We're talking this morning with Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's a director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York City and author of the book, co-author, I should say, with Donald Goldsmith, the book Origins, 14, is it 14 or 15? It's 14 billion years of cosmic evolution. Forgive me.
It's 13.7, but we rounded up.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay.
It's book publishing after all. this will also be the subject of a special airing on Nova on PBS stations everywhere next week. And airs on WILL next Tuesday and Wednesday at 7 p.m. each night. We have one caller waiting and would welcome others if you'd like to join our conversation. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener, someone in Indiana, line number 4. Good morning.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I have a question, but more a little anecdotal information, I guess, in some way. It's sort of interesting. Now I'm retired. I'm back into astronomy again. I started out as a young boy doing the 4-inch telescope and that sort of thing. And when I went to school, I went into astronomy. Then I thought, well, this is physics. I went into physics, and I said, well, this is math. And when I got in there, then I said, a lot of this is philosophy. So that's where I ended up. What I've liked about astronomy over the years is sort of putting my mind against other minds before the telescope was invented, and since having all the information they had and seeing if my quote-unquote intuitions were like theirs in terms of what I would have said about things. I always found that very, very interesting, sort of like at the period with the wave and the particle was in the 19th century was being fought out, and of course the young people came through and did the things with it. I'd like for you to say something in terms of all languages in the world about time. Anytime I get into discussion with people that even are educated and try to explain to them about the Big Bang, well, what was before the Big Bang? And you say, well, there was nothing. And they, well, there's got to be something, there's got to be a beginning somewhere. And I found a lot of the talk by physicists in particular, and astronomers and astrophysicists, somewhat not nailing it down as well as it should be. Because if you're forced to go through the mathematics of it, then you lose about everybody pretty fast on that. But I was wondering is what the general conception is now. How does one explain that to, let's say, an Astronomy 101 class, in a liberal arts college where you have intelligent people, who can understand concepts. How do you get over that one barrier itself? I hope to see that program.
Thanks a lot. And I want to congratulate the caller for refinding his cosmic roots, even if it took until retirement to do so. First of all, time is one of the more mysterious things about us. Everyone can tell you what time it is, but you say, well, what is time? No one, nobody has a really good answer for it. Einstein was attributed to having said that time is defined to make motion look simple. Mm. Time is a construct of the measurement of time is a construct of physics to try to make sense of the passage of events. And when you evaluate the passage of events and then you learn that the universe had a past and then had a beginning, of course it takes you right back to the beginning and you ask, well, what was around before the Big Bang? No, we have an answer for that. The answer is we don't know. That's the answer.
Yeah.
We do not know. And so we can make stuff up, and we got some top people making stuff up right now about what was around before the Big Bang, that we might be one of many universes bubbling up out of what we call a multiverse. And there's some cogent theoretical arguments for why that may be true. There are even philosophical arguments for why that would be true. But there's no evidence to support it. But we do have evidence for everything that happened in the universe from the Big Bang onward. So we revel in that. And yes, we'd like to have all the answers, but one of the hallmarks, one of the facts that reminds you that you are on the frontier of science is that there are unknown questions that lay before you.
Mm-hmm.
You can't lose sleep over that. In fact, to quote the poet Rainer Maria Rilke, sometimes you just have to learn to love the questions themselves.
Mm.
And any good scientist is not going to sit there and just conjure answers just so that they can sit peacefully in their chair. You're going to accept the fact that some questions do not yet have answers, and therein is the source of your drive to try to come to answer them at all.
Mm-hmm. And we have a very good theory for how things happened after a certain point.
That's correct.
After the Big Bang, and I think do we keep pushing that point back, or are we out of theoretical limit?
No, we have
limit?
The point. We know. I mean, it's very shortly after the Big Bang.
Yeah.
In amounts of time that are measured with 30 decimal places,
mm-hmm.
one over one with 30 zeros, that fraction of a second after the Big Bang. Now, that sounds kind of bold to even make such a claim,
yeah.
But what you do is you say, the reason why we think we understand what was going on then is because we assert, well, back then the particles would be this hot, this density, this pressure. You do this, and you look at how matter behaves in the laboratory, mm-hmm. and you say, if that was going on back then, this is what would have come afterwards.
Yeah.
You would get hydrogen. You would get helium. And you unfold the universe that sits in front of us. And that's what gives you confidence that your ideas are accurate as you run the clock back that early. But at T equals zero and before, we don't have answers yet.
We have a couple callers to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. We'll go next to a Champagne listener on line number two. Good morning. Hello?
Oh, gee.
Yes.
That's fast.
Yeah?
Well, I know what time is. It's what nobody ever has enough of.
And, certainly not these days.
You did mention the position of being on the frontier of science, and I think that's very true. But it is a frontier. There's more beyond. And I think in all generations, from the beginning of time probably, there have been doubting Thomases. And there are today, and I'm probably one of them. I don't think the last word's in on all this, and I think naturally you'll agree. But I do get a little irked sometimes when the public is presented with things which are theory based on quite a bit of evidence, but it's presented as if that's the way it really was. And, of course, that's the way it was presented 500 years ago and 1,000 years ago, and there were doubting Thomases around like Galileo and others who sometimes got punished for being doubting Thomases and even for...
You raise a good concern that we should all have. You know, why should anybody believe any of this, especially when you can get an astrophysicist with a straight face to say, yes, we think we understand the Big Bang and all that happened. Oh, by the way, 96% of the universe is made of something about which we know nothing. This is the dark matter and dark energy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that brings the doubting Thomases out of every closet and corner of the room. So, but I have a reply for that might put you a little bit at ease. There are ideas that have only meager evidence in support of them, and so we've got people trying to gather more evidence to see if further experiments either support or refute the ideas. There are other ideas that have such a myriad of supporting evidence that we're ready to go on to the next problem. And there might still be people hanging back because they want to drive it a little further. But, okay, there's a point where you have enough evidence that you no longer can justify your research time continuing to test it. This happened especially in the time of relativity, when Einstein puts forth his radical ideas. A whole lot of people just could not believe it.
Even
so they
Einstein.
Said, I'm going to prove that he's wrong. So they got a grant monies, and they designed an experiment, and the best experiments ever, and sure enough, it turned out correct.
Oh, gee, the way it's proceeding is wonderful. There's no doubt about
right.
it.
Right, and so you do enough of this, and people just give up after a while because it
yeah,
just keeps working.
Let's just accept this and go on from here.
And go on from
that,
there.
That's what
now,
you got to do. But
years ago,
it doesn't, that in itself is not proof that where we think we are is actually where we are.
Well, exactly.
And there's always, you know, I look forward to every new breakthrough. And so,
Only that, sometimes new ideas, in fact, most of the time, new ideas are not the kind that undo what you've done before. What they do is enclose what you've done before
yeah.
into a deeper understanding of how things work. And this is a point that's not widely appreciated in the public. We hear that Einstein's theories forced us to throw Newton out the window. No, that's not how it worked. Einstein's theories still work. His theory of gravity, his motion, and the like,
Newton,
it still works.
Yeah.
It's just that Newton's theories still work. It's just that Einstein's theory of relativity and his theory of gravity apply in more situations than the Newton theories do.
Yeah. Well, there was.
And if you put the speeds that Isaac Newton encountered into Einstein's equations, and the gravity levels into Einstein's equations look like Newton's equations. They reduce to that state.
Yeah, right.
So we're not just throwing one thing out the window and bringing in something else like some kind of ping pong ball bouncing back and forth. There is an accumulated body of knowledge that is real. And it's real not because we say so, but because the evidence consistently supports it.
Well, there was a theory proposed some years ago about that the universe was constantly recreating itself by the miraculous appearance of a hydrogen atom
uh-huh.
in a cubic centimeter every 100 years. Or
that's right.
Yeah.
Remember, that was called the steady state theory of the universe.
A very small amount. And, of course, the critics of that said, well, how are you creating those hydrogen atoms? And, of course, the response was, well, the same way you created all that stuff at nothing in the beginning.
Now, so that made for some good beers. You know,
yeah, right.
Beer fights. In the end, if you're creating new matter, you should also be creating new galaxies. And we looked around and we didn't find the range and age of galaxies that idea would have required. And it had other flaws in it as well as evidence came rolling down. But when that theory first came out, no one had any evidence to refute it, so it had some currency for a while.
Maybe you could update us on the current state of where we are in reaching the so-called edge of the universe. I've been hearing that for years, and each time they get out there to where they think they're near the edge, it seems like it looks the same, little different.
Yeah.
Are we really going to reach the edge of the universe with the new space telescope and stuff like that? And I better leave some time for some other callers here.
Okay.
Thank you very much for the nice program.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah.
But it's an excellent question. Where is the edge? And, you know, it turns out since it takes light time to get from one place to another, because it doesn't travel infinitely fast,
mm-hmm.
the universe serves as this fascinating time tunnel for us, this time machine. The act of simply looking out samples the universe at a time when it was younger. You see a galaxy a billion light years away. You see it not as it is, but as it was a billion years ago. Turns out, since the universe had a beginning 14 billion years ago, if you look out and try to find a galaxy 14 billion light years away, it was being born then.
Right.
So you would see the galaxy being born, and the Next Generation Space Telescope is designed to gather data from that epoch in the history of the universe right when galaxies were being born. And we see evidence of this evolution in the universe. So that's how we know it. You can't make this stuff up. We're sharing with you what the evidence reveals through our telescopes. And that's how we know the universe had a beginning. By the way, that edge, that 14 billion year envelope around us, in a billion years, will be 15 billion light years away. And then 16 billion light years. So that's getting bigger. The universe is growing. Our view of the universe is growing by one light year per year. The actual universe might be infinite. We don't know.
Yeah.
We just can't see beyond the point where things were being born.
So how do we know the age of the universe?
A couple of ways, and this is part of what also gives us confidence. We see how fast the universe is expanding now. You say, well, it's going this fast, and okay, let's turn back the clock. And it's expanding. Let's turn back the clock. At what point was the whole universe in the same spot at the same time? That was 14 billion years ago.
Very interesting. 13.7
billion years
sure.
ago. Then we say, well, okay, that's fine. Let's put a pin in that. Now we've got all these stars here. Let's find the oldest star in the universe. And if the oldest star of the universe is 20 billion years old, you got a problem.
Right.
Because you can't be older than your mother. So we look around. What's the oldest stars in the universe? Coming in at like 13 billion years. They're not older than this date that we get when we trace the clocks back. And these are two completely separate ways of determining age. So it's these kinds of independent means of exploring the universe that gives us confidence in ideas that we have, however cockamamie they came out, they sounded when they were first proposed. And there's a point I'd like to make about the origins, the emergent origins field. It's not simply a set of ideas stapled together. It is a new synthesis of knowledge. If you go back 300 years, there were the natural philosophers. We didn't divide everybody up into chemists and biologists. They were the natural philosophers. These were people who thought about the physical world and came to try to understand it. But then the tools of the trade started splitting people. The biologists used the microscope, the astronomers used the telescope, and the chemist had the chem lab. And the jargon grew up around them, and they started publishing in separate journals, and there everything became separate. But in the last 10 years, they've been coming back together because there are certain questions that you can't answer contained within any of those stovepipes. The biologist finds that there's life thriving at the bottom of the ocean near the ocean sea vents. They had to talk to geologists to understand what was going on down there. The geologist, always looking down because that's where the rocks are, stumble upon Meteor Crater in Arizona, not known by that name at the time. It was just Barringer Crater, had the name of the guy who owned the land. Turns out that crater was left by a meteor that slammed into Earth. The geologists now have to occasionally look up. Then you got the paleontologist. How did all the animals go extinct at one layer? So they say, oh, maybe there were volcanoes. Well, that's because all they ever do is look down. It's time to look up, folks. I've got an asteroid I can hand to you that'll knock out your dinosaurs, flatten them just fine. And so there's this intersection of forces and phenomenon that requires a new emergent wave of science that's now taking place. And all the questions asked by that wave of science relate to the origins of things. And you have astrobiologists, astrochemists, geobiologists, planetary geologists. These are new fields that the series, the ANOVA series, the ANOVA mini-series next week, and the companion book take that frontier and break it open for the public to see and feel so that they can participate, if only vicariously, in that enterprise.
Well, very good. Look forward to seeing that. Our lines are all full, and I want to include as many people
well,
as we can.
Let's keep going. Yeah, I'll try to have snappy answers.
That's all right. No, you're giving great answers. Let me just mention again, our guest is Neil deGrasse Tyson, and the book is Origins, 14 Billion Years of Cosmic Evolution, also the title of the PBS series airing next week, and he's the host of that, co-author of the book. And our lines are full, so we'll go next to someone in Savoy on line number 3. Good morning.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I saw an article about... it involves, you know, some of the prerequisites for intelligent life, and one of these is the progression of time as we, you know, deal with it, you know, today. And so there's been some thought that, you know, like if the progression of time was not as we know it, you know, like where there's a past, a present, and then a future, you know, you couldn't have intelligent life because you wouldn't be able to deal with it. You couldn't plan anything, you couldn't build anything, and so on and so forth. And, you know, so that's always fascinated me, you know, that the way time, you know, there is a past and a present, and we know that there's a future, but we can't see into it. And if you could, you know, if there was a physical force or something that allowed you to go back and forth in time, you'd go crazy. you know, you intelligent life wouldn't be able to exist as we know it.
That's an important point, although it's more of a philosophical.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
As far as we know, everywhere in this universe,
right,
past, present, and future. So
to
say, imagine a universe where the future comes before the past, or something really cockamamie about the timeline, then we can't imagine how life would. Certainly not life as we know it. But those are not what we consider our greatest challenges at the moment. The greatest challenges are, and we spend great lengths on this in the book and in the series, is looking at what are the precursors for life as we know it in the universe as we know it.
And there's no doubt that there's, you know, that there's other forms of life out there somewhere.
Well, it's, the universe is so large.
Yeah, it's so large.
And you look at what we're made of. We're made of the most common ingredients in the cosmos.
Right, yeah.
Hydrogen, oxygen, carbon.
Yeah.
If we were made of some isotope of bismuth or something, then you could say, hey, we're special. You know, we got some special ingredients in us. But no. And our chemistry is based on carbon. That's the stickiest element on the entire periodic table.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to base a complex and fascinating chemistry on a single element, carbon is your man. And the talk about whether you'd find silicon-based life somewhere else, because silicon has similar bonding characteristics to carbon,
mm-hmm,
except that carbon, there's five times as much carbon as there is silicon in the universe. So you don't even need the silicon.
Yeah.
Carbon works just fine. And plus, carbon can make bonds that are strong enough to sort of work, but not so strong that you can't keep experimenting with it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is everywhere. So if we, as we look out in space, we have every right to look for life as we know it, because the rest of the universe is the content of the rest of the universe is as we know it.
Oh,
so that's my... That's how we're doing it.
Okay. Our lines remain full, so let's go on and talk with some more listeners. We have someone next in Belgium on line number 4. That's Belgium, Illinois, not Europe. Good morning.
Good morning. To get back to your basic concept of how do we know where we're at, the problem is we might not have a frame of reference that we can deal with. Like if you're a point, you don't know that you're a point unless you know about lines, and lines, planes, three dimensions, and three dimensions you have to go to time. Now, if we don't have a perspective to see where this universe is at, we really can't understand it now, can we?
That's not completely true. We wouldn't be able to understand it if we didn't have tools that allow us perspectives that don't otherwise reach our five senses. So, for example... I mean, you're absolutely right. If you were a line person, you'd have no way to think of the plane person. If you're a plane person, that's P-L-A-N-E. If you're a plane person, you have no way to know the volumetric person, the three-dimensional person. However, we can describe these circumstances mathematically. And in the math, we can start raising the dimensions. Even if you can't conceive it, can't picture it, can't draw it, even if it gives you queasy stomach, the math can do it. And that's why you have string theorists talking about 11-dimensional space, 10-dimensional space, in which our universe is embedded. You can do the math. And that's one of the remarkable things about math as the language of the cosmos. And I'd rather revel in the fact that math works at all, because it's completely conjured up by the human mind, yet it seems to be just the right language to get us to understand how things work. So that's kind of remarkable unto itself. But not that we can't imagine certain things. The math takes us there.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Okay. Thanks so much for the call. We'll go on and talk with some more listeners. Next up, someone in Urbana on line number 1. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. You had talked about the new space telescope being able to push back to the origins of the universe.
Origins of galaxies, but it's pretty close to the beginning of the universe,
okay.
Right?
I stand corrected. How is the new space telescope going to be different than Hubble? Will it be looking at different wavelengths, or is it just a larger aperture that can see further on? Can you please tell me the differences that will enable us to get to that point?
Yeah, excellent question. It'll be doing both. The Hubble telescope is specifically tuned to look at visible light, of course, the kind of light that our eyes are most sensitive to. But visible light is this tiny smidgen in the full spectrum. In the full electromagnetic spectrum is what we call it. And that's what contains a lot of familiar bands that we know about, even if you hadn't thought about them that way. X-rays, gamma rays, infrared, ultraviolet. These are all light. But the only part of that light we can see is what we call visible light, and that's the rainbow of colors. But astronomers have known for some time that the whole universe doesn't come to us by way of visible light, that you need telescopes sensitive to other bands of light. Invisible to us, but we have detectors that can measure it. The next generation space telescope, recently named the James Webb Telescope, after the head of NASA during the Apollo program, that telescope, it will be larger than Hubble, much larger, actually, and be sensitive to infrared light. And it's, we expect that the light coming to us from these newborn galaxies will reach us in the form of infrared. So it's specially tuned just for the most distant universe. And so that's what we do every next telescope that we build or conceive or invent, is to try to answer whole other sets of questions not previously addressed.
Another quick question. Was the early universe emitting primarily in the infrared, or were there, is that how it, the light is now filtered coming through the universe, or am I asking the right question there?
You're asking really good questions.
Oh, good.
The early universe, in fact, the time that we are seeking to decode, in fact, while there surely was infrared light being emitted, that was not the predominant form of light. The predominant form of light was very high energy light, ultraviolet light and X-ray light. Turns out, if you want to see the universe that far away, that high energy light has been traveling now for nearly 14 billion years, and it's been stretched out by the expansion of the universe, and its energy has dropped, and it now lands in the infrared part of the spectrum. So we are exploiting the fact that what was going on back then today looks like it's infrared light. And so we build an infrared telescope to see the X-ray light and the ultraviolet light that it was born with at the beginning of time.
So
that was a great question.
The more the stretch, or the more the expansion of the universe between us and point of origin, then the more infrareddish the energy that gets to us?
That's correct. In fact, as you keep stretching, you go not only from infrared, you get into even lower energy light, which are microwaves. And in fact, the famous cosmic microwave background, that wasn't born as microwaves. That was born as in fact, visible light. That was light like the color of the surface of the sun.
Neat.
And that got stretched out, and now you need radio telescopes, microwave telescopes, to detect it. And so it's kind of, we're exploiting these facts about the universe. And, it takes some clever design to do this, and then, it's what the frontier of science is all about, finding ways that no one thought of before to try to go further than anyone had been before.
And lastly, how big is the mirror or the aperture on that new...
I don't have the latest numbers on it. It started out, imagine, as an 8-meter mirror that would be unfurled once it got into space. So it wouldn't be launched as a big disk, 8-meter disk. It would be some kind of deployable disk. Mm. And lately it's been shrunk down a little bit, been sort of downsized to about 6 meters, but I don't have the very latest number, but it's on that scale. The Hubble telescope was 90-some-odd inches, so that was 2 meters across. So it would be a significantly larger collecting area
Great.
Than the Hubble telescope.
Thank you.
Thanks
sure.
so much for the call. We have just about 8 minutes left with our guest, Neil deGrasse Tyson, talking about the Nova series Origins, which airs next week, and also the book Origins, which is published by Norton, and you can find that as well. Our lines remain full, so we'll go next to another listener in Urbana, line number 2. Good morning.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
You were saying a little while back about how people, the line person and the plane person who live in different amounts of dimension universes wouldn't understand each other. And I just happened right now to be in the middle of reading this short novella that was written over 100 years ago, back in the late 19th century, called Flatland.
Oh, the Edwin Abbott book.
What's that?
By Abbott?
Yeah, sounds about right. I don't remember exactly.
Okay, yeah. In fact, I should have mentioned that when the other caller had called in. That's a fascinating exploration.
Yeah.
In culture clashes, right? Because the sphere people had more power than the plane people, and there's a whole culture built into that.
The squares and the triangles, and then and every different kind of people had a different number of sides.
Wow,
that was a kind of weird. I actually just downloaded it right off the internet.
I've heard of it. I haven't read it.
It's called Flatland.
Yeah,
actually,
right.
that's not what I wanted to talk about.
Okay, but thanks for calling that to the listener's attention.
Yeah, what I really was one thing I really find entertaining is. is how the you know, science winds up making its way into the popular culture.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, back when I was younger, everybody would talk about how everything's relative, because you know, Einstein was big then. And there was one time I was doing jury duty, and the defense attorney said, well, he really liked having physicists in the jury, because the physicists can see that tiny quantum of evidence or doubt, the quantum of doubt, you know, that might find the you know, the person innocent. And then also I've seen in one financial markets that I've been kind of cruising the internet, I've seen this one individual, financial analyst, who uses a system that involves what he calls quantized price levels, where the prices he claims tend to jump in these quantum jumps. And I just thought that was kind of interesting how people just kind of grab onto stuff like that just in...
Well, no doubt about it. And even if the concepts are applied differently, the vocabulary is certainly out there. Look at how many cars have names that are drawn from cosmic objects,
yeah,
including the entire car company, Saturn.
Mm-hmm.
There's Mercury Car Company. Remember the old Galaxy 500, the Chevy Nova, the Subaru. Subaru in Japanese is the Pleiades, this little star, mm-hmm, cluster that's in the night sky. So no doubt about it, the public is reaching for science to get some kind of, maybe on some level, legitimacy for whatever else they might be doing. But the more fun part is just to have fun with the language.
Yeah. Can I say just one more thing before I get off?
Sure.
You know, I just spent, it took me just years and years and years before I really felt like I was starting to get an understanding of what, you know, modern physics is really about, and get an appreciation for it.
As it takes years for someone to be fluent in a language, so don't,
right,
you know, don't be ashamed of that fact.
Yeah, and I think that really a deep understanding of these kinds of things is, I don't really think it's for everyone, and I think there, in a lot of ways, there actually can be kind of a loss of innocence in learning about these things that can be very, very different from way, you know, from the way we see things as we get up in the morning and go about our lives. And so I would say, you know, physics and cosmology should be for people who really are fascinated by it, because I think it's the most interesting subject in the world. But I think it should be for people who really do enjoy it, and I think anyone who does would just enjoy studying it very much.
Well, we try to bring it to you. I mean, that's why we got the series and the companion book, and I'm not alone in this effort. There are other, many of my colleagues are very engaged in this sort of activity. So, but thanks for your interest.
You know, I think the caller raises an interesting issue for me, you know, and I'm reminded of, you know, Arthur C. Clarke's 2001, and then the follow-up movie. This is a fictionalized account, obviously, of events in our solar system. The bottom line message for me was, you know, the universe is a much stranger and bigger place, and we are such a small part of it that we should be, maintain some humility, and maybe all these problems, you know, global war, which in the storyline was threatening the planet Earth, are really insignificant in terms of the universe, and we need to broaden our horizons and stop fussing so much at each other. And I guess I wonder if you think that that's something that you know, is a natural sort of consequence of exploring the universe, that we get a bigger view and take ourselves less seriously in our
lives. No doubt about it. You need the reminder that from space you look down on the land masses of Earth and there are no national boundaries,
yeah,
in view. And you remind how small, what kind of a speck we are. And you refer to the humility of that. That's another parallel word. Another parallel word is it's humbling. The cosmic perspective is humbling. And it's humbling in the right way. It's the kind of way where if I spend a long periods of time looking up, and then I come back and read the next day's newspaper, I feel like, people! You know, I feel like slapping everybody who's out there. It's like, you know, can you get a grip on our place in the cosmos? And you know, it's so obvious once you've spent time looking up in space, but if you're in the middle of it down here on Earth, you think that's the most important thing ever, and
yeah,
that's, and that your view is more important than somebody else's view, and it's terribly unhealthy. So yes, there's something magical about the cosmic perspective that not enough people have.
We have a couple calls waiting, and I'm sorry, won't probably get to both of them, but we'll squeeze in at least one last caller here, line number 4 in Charleston. Good morning.
thanks. I was just talking about the looking back far enough to begin to see some of the origins or the earlier days of the universe. If our ability to look farther back continues, won't we, or maybe there's already been some evidence of everything seeming to happen in the same place? I mean, ultimately, if it started out as a big bang, if we could ever look back that far, it would be at one point. Do we get any indications now that the areas of the sky in which the oldest objects have been detected are appearing in a more restricted space than just randomly distributed everywhere?
That's an excellent question, and the answer to that is yes. As we look farther back in time, the galaxies, which are the same size then as they were today, actually occupy a greater percentage of the available volume of the universe back then. And that's the evidence, one of many points of evidence, that shows that the universe was a smaller place. It was a smaller place back then than it is today. And you look back and you find that the total ensemble of matter was denser back then than it is today. And the universe was hotter back then than it is today. All of these features, which are fundamental elements of the Big Bang concept of what was going on, all play out in the data sets as they unfold. So yes, we're looking back to a smaller and smaller and smaller universe.
Well, and it has become a very big universe, and there's a lot we could talk about, but we're unfortunately out of time here.
Can I slip in something real quick? I know you want to
run
out of time.
Sure.
The other caller said that the prosecuting attorney liked physicists on the panel. Last time I went for jury duty, I was like, they kicked me out minutes later after I was interviewed, and they found out that I do astrophysics. I was teaching a class on the unreliability of eyewitness testimony in the reporting of science.
Oh, dear. That'd be a problem.
And then I said, no further questions. I was back on the street 10 minutes later. So,
well, interesting. Well, there's, as I say, so much more we could talk about. It's been so interesting talking with you. The book is full of a great deal more on this along this line. The book is Origins, 14 Billion Years of Cosmic Evolution.
It's just released this week. I mean, it might not even be on the shelves yet. You can
well,
check it out.
Yeah. Certainly look for it. Publisher is Norton, and also the Nova series next week airs Tuesday and Wednesday here on WILL, certainly on PBS stations nationwide. Again, the title is Origins, and the host of that has been our guest, Neil deGrasse Tyson, director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York City. Dr. Tyson, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
It's a pleasure. Great questions from all your listeners.
All right.